This is Civic Media, bringing you news, talk, and community-minded conversations all across Wisconsin. You can find us at civicmedia.us and download the app for free today. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cuska, sports director for Civic Media. Right now, we're airing a Packers, Badgers, Brewers, or Bucks game over the air, but due to our rights agreements, we're not able to stream those games here. Civic Media might be a newer company, but we are dedicated to providing the best in sports coverage. Our team has decades of experience covering sports right here in Wisconsin. We've got Mike Clemens, who covers our state's biggest teams on location and does daily updates on all of our Civic Media stations statewide. Many of our stations have local reporters dedicated to teams in their area, covering their communities dozens or even hundreds of times each year. No matter where you're at in Wisconsin, we are committed to covering sports, especially in the communities that our stations serve. And we put all of our local coverage right here on our stream, so you can go ahead and grab the free Civic Media app so you never miss a game at civicmedia.us/app. You can find the game you're looking for over the air, or you can stay tuned right here on the stream for more news, talk, and conversation. Thank you for listening to Civic Media from all of us here on the sports team.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Over the last week, clerks around Wisconsin have been putting their election equipment to the test. It's a common practice. They've been doing it for years. But these days, they hope inviting the public to see it all for themselves helps prevent misinformation. Mike Moen reports.
According to the Wisconsin Elections Commission, all municipalities must conduct a public test of their electronic voting equipment within 10 days of each election. Algoma City Clerk Aaron Miller describes it as a pretty detailed run-through.
We will take the voting machine out of the vault, and we will go through the whole process of putting the cartridges in the places where they're supposed to go, adding the safety seals, recording the safety seals, and then putting the test ballots through the machine to ensure accuracy.
In a recent Gallup poll, 57% of Americans say they're confident votes for president this year will be accurately counted. However, partisan gaps have widened, with faith and accuracy waning among Republican respondents. In a battleground state like Wisconsin, Miller says these tests are important so administrators can show how consistent they are in overseeing elections. She says they're a good training opportunity, too.
I have my poll workers put a blank ballot through so they can see what happens, you know, with the machine. I have them put a ballot that somebody maybe happened to overvote in a certain selection, so they can see how the machine is going to react to that.
If something abnormal pops up during testing, state law requires local clerks to remedy the situation before voters can use that machine on election day. Administrators around the country have said they're relying on aging voting equipment, with calls to boost federal funding for that type of infrastructure. Miller says her team is lucky because their machines were recently upgraded. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Here today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. The Wall Street Journal, the newspaper of the investor class, had an interesting article pointing out that Americans are more reliant than ever on government aid. That's the headline, that's the title, that's the point. And they go through and talk about how many counties in this country, the ones that are small, the ones that are, you know, rural, the ones that are home to about 22% of the population, tend to, well, overwhelmingly rely on government spending. And oddly enough, these counties, and this is something I've been saying for a very long time, these counties rely on, well, you guessed it, they rely on government aid. And they vote for Republicans. And this is the weird part in this where you go, there's a disconnect in the I hate government, get government out of my life, get your government hands off my Medicare, and, well, the reality of what goes into people's kitchen tables. And what they did is they looked at the map of government spending, and, you know, what they're saying is it explains the rise of Trump, because these are areas that have economic stagnation. These are areas that have seen the factory leave. It's what we've been talking about on this program for a very long time. the used-to-be's, the places that used to be the economic powerhouses of the past that lived through deindustrialization, and nothing filled the void. So Fox News, right-wing talk radio, got in there, radicalized these folks because Democrats didn't bother talking to them. And now they have this hope, this belief that Donald Trump's going to be the savior. And for all the talk that, you know, Trump is racist and he's misogynistic and he's all this stuff, he is. But that's not why everyone, all them voted for him. They voted for him because they bought the message. They bought the hope. They bought the, you know, the ketchup popsicle while wearing white gloves and a wedding dress in the desert heat. Because it's, as I say, a drowning man will grab an anchor in the hopes that will help them. And that's what this is. And as I explained back in 2016, I said Trump was going to win because my family, otherwise known as the basket of deplorables, who are racist, who are homophobic, who are misogynistic, who are all those things, that never got them to vote before. But the promise that they're going to bring back the manufacturing prowess of the city, the jobs that come with manufacturing, the good union jobs with good solid wages, that got them motivated. The idea that Trump was going to, he was a businessman, he was going to bring business back. And this is what you hear from rural America all the time. You know, we're going to get the factory back and we're going to get jobs again, and that's going to be the bedrock of our prosperity. And one of the places that they point out in this article is Johnstown, Pennsylvania. For those who don't know, Johnstown was a steel-making powerhouse. And the 70s, 80s, you saw a massive decline. So much so that the city has shed, according to the article, half its population since 1970. The number of workers, the Wall Street Journal points out, have fallen there more than 10% since 2000. And a number of the business establishments, the businesses are leaving. They said, look, renewal hasn't arrived. And what you have is you have Republicans who are Republicans in these areas who are voting for Trump. Trump won the area 68%. The punchline here is, and again, this is one of those things where you go, there's a disconnect here. The anti-government people, the people who are distrustful of government, who hate government, 35% of the county income comes from the federal government or the state government's safety net programs. Social Security, Medicare, food stamps, Medicaid. Go down, earned income tax credit. Go down LIHEAP. Go down the list. And they're not alone. Look, a lot of communities across this state and across the country. Look, this isn't unique to Pennsylvania. They pointed out that about 70% of the counties in Michigan, Georgia, and North Carolina were significantly reliant on government income. 60% in Pennsylvania. Arizona, 13 of the 15 counties, heavily reliant on safety net income. Now, this isn't new. We're not Magellan discovering new lands. We know this is the reality. The question then comes to, you had 4 years of Donald Trump. What did he do? What did he propose? What legislation did he move through to get to his desk to get signed? Was there an infrastructure bill? Was there that $3 trillion infrastructure bill he promised? Because I'll tell you, if he put it up, I'd have supported it. And I'd have been railing on Democrats to support it. But he never put it up. What about that healthcare bill that was supposed to cover everybody and cheap? Where's the plan for that? I know there's a concept or a structure of a concept or maybe a blank piece of paper with a pen next to it that might write something itself. I don't know. But the sad reality is the people who are hurting the worst, the people who are literally drowning, are grabbing the anchor. These are the people who somehow they think Donald Trump is going to be the savior and bring prosperity back. And look, I got family members who think this way because it's all they got. Because they don't believe that the Democrats can deliver. And the Democrats have. Look, there have been factories being built across this country. The right wing has such a powerful messaging machine that none of that stuff ever gets talked about. The corporate-controlled media, they're not celebrating the victories of the Biden administration. They're not pointing out the factories that are building, they're being built, the jobs that are being created, the lives that are getting better. No. They're not doing that at all because that doesn't sell papers. The clickbait ain't there, man. Positivity doesn't sell. What sells is misery, fear, pain, and suffering. Here's a reality, rural America, and I say this to my neighbors all the time. You cannot take the handout from the government that you then decry. You cannot be the one who's getting the programs you want destroyed. Now, I'm a big believer in public investment, sound investment, solid policy. And I think Harris, I know Biden did a lot of that, and I believe Harris will continue that to make these areas great again in a real way, not just a rhetorical, cute little bumper sticker way. But it's interesting, the policies in red America that benefit them, brought to them by blue politicians. Interesting. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, our corporate-controlled mainstream media being as schizophrenic or Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde as you can be, some report our economy as the envy of the world. Some are saying that the U.S. economy leaves the rest of the world in the dust. The best economy ever. Things are wonderful. Things are great. Everything's fabulous. And then you flip the coin and polar opposite. The sky's falling, or recession's around the corner, depression's coming, it's collapsing. So the question is which is reality? I know each of us, the economy's personal. It's how are we doing today? And interestingly enough, I talk to a lot of people who think the economy's collapsing, and they're actually, when they get down to it, doing pretty well. And here to share some thoughts on this mixed messaging going on, I've asked my good friend Mateus Vernango to come talk with us. Mateus is an economics professor at Bucknell University, one of my favorite guys, one of my favorite bloggers. You can find him over at nakedkeynesianism.blogspot.com. Mateus, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
So what's with this mixed messaging? Look, I mean, I understand the economy's personal. It's how you're doing today, how you're able to put food on the table, keep a roof over your head, clothes on the kids' back, all of that stuff. But the economic numbers, every metric that we use, say, man, we're killing it globally.
If you go to the blog, there's a graph that I sort of did showing how much more the United States has grown than, Germany. Germany has stagnated, since the pandemic. The UK has done very poorly, so much so that the Labour Party won the election in a landslide. Almost all economies, have done relatively poorly. Even those that grow fast, like China, I should say, China's growing way less now than it used to grow. It used to grow 10%, it's growing at 5%. The United States had not only a very good recovery, The recovery from this last recession was incredibly fast. It's the first, recovery that has been jobless, in many decades. But also, it happened at the same time that inflation that was not caused, I should say, and we can talk about that, by the fiscal packages of the Biden administration, came down. So we are in a situation in which inflation is almost at the target level. And by the way, if inflation is, 2.4 or inflation is 2%, it's not a big difference. And unemployment is relatively low, it's 4.1 or whatever it is, And so with the labor market at, it's reasonably good. So I think that the reason why, I think that there is no doubt. It's those are facts. I mean, you can have your own opinions, but you cannot have your own facts. The old sort of Patrick Moynihan sort of story. I think it was, but I think that there is something that one has to acknowledge of why some people may be feeling some pain, and I think that part of the story is that there are certain places in the economy that the inflation has sort of remained a little bit higher. So if you look at the items that, sort of kept a little bit up, were associated in particular to rental, as, the BLS puts it. It's housing. So people are paying more, I suppose, for the housing that they used to. And that probably has squeezed some other kinds of expenditures that people would like to have. And that, may be part of the story. Of course, the other thing is, we have a very fast recovery, we're growing fast, but in an economy that over the last 40 years, has created significant inequality and that has led to a lot of resentment. And so even if you're better off, some people may still feel, well, I'm paying more for my rent than I used to. And in all fairness, I look at my parents and they were doing much better at my age than I'm doing. And so that may explain, in my view, some of the malaise. It cannot explain the notion that we're on the verge of a collapse, because we're anything but. So we're not close to a collapse. The economy is not doing terrible. The economy is doing, incredibly well. As, I say, and I say in the blog, it takes a lot for me to agree with The Economist, but The Economist is right. The American economy is the envy of the world.
Right. No, and I look at this, and what's interesting to me is I talk to people who are doing, from the outside, doing very well. And when you talk to them, they go, yeah, well, maybe I'm doing okay. But they always give me another example of somebody else. And it's usually anecdotal. And this is where the world that I unfortunately have found myself, because I'm in a situation where I meet a lot of people who are solidly middle class. And it's just this level of complaining that they think the country's in abject poverty and don't even know what abject poverty really looks like.
Let me tell you this story of, typical of Latin America. So, in Argentina, where I was born, there is this sort of traditional story. So, how is the economy? And people will come and say, oh, it's terrible. It's a disaster. It's, this thing, will collapse any minute now. And how are you doing? Oh, great. But that's because I'm so good that I managed to do things in the middle of this disaster.
Right.
So everybody's a genius, But this was when the economy was growing, recovering from a big crisis. Argentina is very often in the middle. It's never the envy of the world. But they were recovering from a terrible crisis, and they all were complaining still of is the worst of the crisis. So I think that there is an element of that. If things are going well, it's you. I've done my job and I'm great. But the economy is terrible. But if it's tanking, oh, it's the fault of the government. And I think that there is an element of that, too.
No, I'm there with you. But the housing thing you bring up is very real. And I argue the inflation that we suffered under, the inflation, especially in housing, I believe that's corporate driven. And I've been saying that from the beginning. Good old fashioned red blooded American greed and collusion and all of that stuff that
lack of investment. There is no money to be made in this, and so we have invested and we have invested in condos, in places that are not needed. So you go to Vegas and there is a bunch of condos that were empty, after the housing bubble and whatnot. And then you have places in which there is a dire need of low cost sort of housing, and there is none. So we have homeless people, all over. And that, again, it's a failure of public policy. And in part because we have had policies that don't allow the government, you know, those are issues that, you know, going back to the New Deal, the Federal Housing Authority, to, you know, creating cheap credit for people to buy and build their own houses and so on and so forth. So there are ways of dealing with this. And I'm sorry to say, you know, the push for conservative sort of economics and for free markets has sort of in a place in which, you know, public housing is necessary. So a hand of the state to provide relatively cheap housing at decent prices is sort of necessary.
Because I was going to ask you about this because, you know, each candidate, they've got their positions. I think, again, corporate America has been buying up all the rental properties, been jacking up prices because they can, because there isn't the building of lower cost rentals or lower cost housing like my grandparents were able to get. There were little Levittowns built all across this country to provide stable, good, solid housing for the GIs coming back from World War II. And they were good, solid homes, reasonably priced, but it was a public-private partnership. The government funded it. Contractors made a little bit of money on it. They mass-produced these communities, and people got good standards of living out of it. None of that stuff, in my view, is happening. So I'm curious, you know, one, is it possible you think to get back to that? And two, how do you see each side, the Trump idea of, well, we've got we might have a plan, or Harris's idea of giving $25,000 to a new first-time home buyer?
So, I mean, giving money to first-time home buyers is a good idea. So I have nothing against that idea. My first house, bought in Salt Lake City with FHA loan with zero down. So those things are sort of good policies that help people that do have a job, that, you know, have certain facilities to start, you know. And mind you, we need more than that. We need, as I say, I'm for, I think, a more hands-on, sort of approach. I think we need to have the government investing and public investment in this. I think that unless you have, you know, a government intervention relying on market solutions and giving money so that people have choice, will have a limited impact in solving the problem. Mind you, that's much better than let markets solve these things, you know. If you let Trump, there'll be as much building of houses as of walls in the border with Mexico. You know, he promised one, of course, you know, he built.
Clearly. And Mexico didn't pay for it. But this is the thing. I've had the argument from people that say Donald Trump's a builder. He's going to build homes for people. There's a belief out there that he's going to do something that he's never said he's actually going to do, which is remarkable to me. But again, it's what's thrown out there, because I don't know if you saw the Washington Post piece the other day where they went through a whole bunch of policy positions, and they found that the majority of people in this country, by a huge number, policy-wise, are in the Harris-Walls camp and not the Trump camp, because, well, we want intervention to help make lives better.
Sure. No, I mean, that's part of the problem. I mean, how many people, you know, even things that are not in my purview, I always say, everybody, you ask people what they think about, you know, background checks, and it's like 80%, I don't know, the numbers are staggering. How can we not pass legislation in which everybody, you know, sort of is in favor of? So I think that with respect to housing, you know, I think it's mind you, housing is not something that would solve the issues of what people tend, you know, the inflation or the notion of a malaise or all of those things. It's kind of a public policy thing that, as you were saying, generates kind of a sense of long term
stability and wealth building. That's how my grandparents were able to go from being homeless when they got married to leading a very solid middle-class lifestyle and dying with respect in that home by having the three-legged stool that helped them in the retirement, help buying their first home so that they could raise their family. There was a lot of government policy that went into helping build that American dream of the 50s and 60s.
I think that's absolutely right. But I think in terms of the election and the things I'm sort of concerned of, those differences that you say, most people are on the side of the, you know, of the Harris-Waltz sort of policy issues. But I think that what they probably failed at is to convey more strongly some of this populists, in the good sense of the word, you know, sort of messages. So there has been less of a emphasis on things like, higher minimum wage, higher wages in general, of increasing social security benefits, of expanding, you know, health coverage, of really regulating. So that there has been all of this sort of chatter whether we're going to continue regulating monopolies or not, and whether we're going to be harsher on Wall Street, and that kind of stuff. And I think that Waltz obviously Harris did with the vice president sort of pointed out in the direction of a more populist campaign. I think that was good. I think that there has been a lot of talk about how fascist Trump is, which is true. I'm not here denying that. But I think that that's a debate that gets us away from the things that people are interested in. And I think we needed to discuss those short-term economic issues, you know, gives people a reason to hope for better times.
No, I'm right there with you. Look, you know, a friend of mine and I were just having this conversation about how, you know, customer service in this country is done. There's no such thing as customer service because there's no competition anywhere. You will take what you get. And as my wife used to tell our children, you'll take what you'll get and you won't throw a fit. And that's how we're dealt with as consumers now, because we're in the monopoly stage. We're in the death stage of capitalism because there is no competition and they know it. So there's nowhere for you to go, which is the sad reality. And I think the American people, I think they get that. They just don't know what to do about it.
Yes, I think that's again, we're in a place that, like the Gilded Age, this second Gilded Age is with us. So it's a world of billionaires. I always ask kids, tell me the name of billionaires, millionaires of the late 19th century. They all know names, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers, and tell me the billionaires of now, and they all know their Bezos and Musks and whatnot, and tell me the millionaires of the 50s, and they cannot come up with one name because we tax them. So that's another thing that I think we should do more, tax the wealthy, instead of giving them huge subsidies, to Elon Musk that is out there saying that, vote for Trump and get, the government off my back, when he's getting billions of dollars from the government. And so I think that that's why I think that a more populist message was necessary because this shouldn't be even close, even with an electoral college. This shouldn't be even a close election. So the fact that it's going to be close, particularly here in Pennsylvania, is to me sort of hard to understand.
So let me kind of wrap this up, answer the question that was posed to me yesterday. And I had to, I literally laughed at the person when they asked me, and I did not answer. I just walked away. But are we better off now than we were 4 years ago?
Oh, we're so much better. Jesus, economically, morally, in so many ways. I mean, again, it doesn't mean that we're in the best of all possible worlds. So there are many things that could be improved, and there are lots of problems, and there are still lots of problems within the Democratic Party. But I always say to people, progressive people, people interested in the well-being of working class people, it's within the Democratic Party that you can fight that fight. Because, there's one party that it's for higher wages, for unions. Trump may say, things about unions and whatnot, but, he won't do anything, for a union. He cannot commit to having higher minimum wages. And even things that, I think have hurt the Democratic Party and the Harris campaign, the terrible issues going in Israel and Palestine, Trump will be much worse. So if there is a space to fight on one end of this, it would be within the Democratic Party. Michael Harrington, an old intellectual that was, sort of concerned with poverty issues and sort of a lefty in the Democratic Party, he always says, you fight it within the party, because you can push the party to fight for your causes.
No, this is what I tell my friends who say, we need a labor party. I go, no, we need to take over one of the two existing parties and make that the labor party.
Yes.
And as I said about this recent convention that the Democrats held in Chicago, that's as close to a labor party as I think we're going to get in this country, what they put on in Chicago.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, I would tend to agree with you. I don't know that we're going to have a Labour Party, but I think we can have a coalition in which inside the Democratic Party, Labour interests are very strong, and they have to be stronger. So the only way to do that is, you know, fight it inside. And again, I think that with Biden, there was a movement towards the left. And one, you know, I think the indication of Waltz is, again, as against other possible candidates, including Governor Shapiro, I think it was an indicator that she wanted to keep a foot with Labour.
Yep, I agree. Absolutely. We're going to find out what happens in a couple of days and where the American people and where the pulse is. But, Matthias, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Thanks for your insight.
Thank you for having me.
Good stuff. Our good friend, Matthias Vernango. Check out his stuff over at nakedkeynesianism.blogspot.com. Does incredible work. Must read. Want to hear your thoughts. The economy, good, bad, indifferent? Is this the issue? Come next Tuesday. Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Right back.
Looking for the game? Find us over the air for sports coverage on Civic Media stations.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
Civic Media is your spot for sports. From updates on your favorite teams, live broadcasts of the Packers, Badgers, Brewers, and Bucks, and local sports coverage in your community, we've got everything you need. Find a station near you at civicmedia.us or download the free app today. We'll have more news and talk coming up here on Civic Media's stream.
Wisconsin Decides 2024. As the campaigning comes to an end and your ballot is cast, you'll find continuing coverage of this important election right here.
Special reports start at 6 November 5th, and when the polls close at 8, coverage of the presidential, Senate, and your important local races will come in from around the state.
It's your vote as Wisconsin Decides on November 5th, starting at 6 p.m. on 98.9 WXCO and the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, I got to tell you, this election cycle, probably one of the biggest elections that I can remember on the merch side. You know, everybody's now got flags. If you remember, you know, last election, you saw a lot of the Trump flags. There were Trump flags everywhere. I'm seeing more Harris flags in my neighborhood than I'm seeing Trump flags. So both sides are buying tons of merch. The shirts, the hats, the flags, the you name it, it's out there. And as a guy who believes in Made in America, I always ask my swag-wearing friends, so where'd you get that? Where was it made? Whose job was created because of it? And unfortunately, too often than not, unless they got it from the campaign, it was made somewhere else, mostly China. And here to share some thoughts on maybe we need some kind of legislative fix. You know, kind of like we have the Berry Amendment for military stuff. Maybe we need an election amendment to make sure that we get our stuff right here at home. And we don't have an election that benefits the Chinese Communist government. Here to share some thoughts on all of that, our good friend Scott Paul. He's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. This should be right up his alley. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it is good to be with you.
So too far on the idea of some kind of legislative fix to make sure that we know that the red hats or blue hats or shirts or flags, where they're made, too much?
No, I think it's all good. In fact, I was going to call it the Rick Berry Amendment because just combining you and the Berry Amendment together seemed to make a lot of sense there, man.
I was thinking the basketball player.
The merch stuff. And let's be clear here. You know, an actual campaign that's paying for merchandise that's made overseas is committing political suicide, right? I mean, no one does that anymore, not even Trump. I mean, no one, I don't know the last candidate who did that, but all of that stuff is made in the United States. The very cool official hat, the camo hat that Harrison Walls have that's sold out like 8 times or whatever, is made in New Jersey by Union Wear. And it's actually, they're actually Union made, American made, great company. But and this is what you're getting to, is that if you're just like Googling or looking online, then you're like, Trump hat or Harris hat or flag or something like that. Yeah, the odds are it's going to be knockoff stuff that is manufactured in China. And you're going to end up sending your dollars to the a Chinese company or an importer. And the stuff is not made in the United States at all. And people should really pay attention to that. I totally agree with you. And if you're willing to stake your own reputation and say, I'm with this candidate or that candidate or this cause or that cause, you should do a little bit of research.
Yep.
And just make sure you're on solid ground and say, yeah, this is made in the United States. This was made ethically.
And for me, if you're a candidate and you don't have the union bug on your T-shirt like I have on mine, you don't get my vote ever. Because that's the red line for me. Because that tells me it was made here and made with union labor, which I know those people are making good wages, good benefits, safe working conditions, all of those things. And it speaks more about the candidate than about the T-shirt, obviously, because if you put that bug on a shirt, you know what you're saying.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You reminded me that when I was a very young man and I ran for the state legislature myself in Indiana, and you would get like these yard signs and you went to the print shop and they ask you all these questions and about the design and the colors and all of that. And they're like, do you want the union bug on it? Because this is a union child. I was like, of course I want the union bug on it. Why did you even ask me this?
Yep.
They're like, well, some candidates who are Republicans don't want the union bug on it. I'm like, who are these people? Why would they not want to do this? I mean, do they think it's costing them votes? No way. It's doing the opposite, as you suggested, because people look out for it.
And look,
you're supporting a good cause.
Yeah, look, maybe it's because I grew up in the 70s. And you had the ILGWU who had that union label song that still gets stuck in my head because I look for the union label. And for me, as someone who wants things made in the U.S., who wants jobs here at home, that union label is that the union bug that's on my shirt is kind of like the check mark, like the certification that I know it was made here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so I just if your listeners get anything out of this, I hope it's that. Yes, please buy lots of campaign merchandise. Make sure it's the official stuff that is guaranteed to be made in the United States, right? That's what you got to do. Just do 5 seconds worth of research to make sure that you're on solid ground.
Or look, this is where I keep coming back to, and we've talked about this before, where Amazon should have a button saying, look, I only want American-made stuff. There should be something that helps the consumer rather than continues to put roadblocks in front of it. At least that's my thought. But I want to move on because I got to get your thoughts on a couple of other things. Congressman Ro Khanna put out a tweet that I thought was really important. And he tweeted out, he said, in the 70s, factories provided 1 in 4 adults with good paying jobs. He said, the U.S. gutted domestic manufacturing. We've hollowed out the middle class. It's time to embrace a new economic patriotism and revitalize U.S. manufacturing in modern steel, solar, and semiconductors. And this got me thinking, look, you know, when I was a kid, a lot of people worked in factories, and those jobs are gone. Those factory jobs were good, decent wage, family sustaining wage jobs that sadly too many communities across this country have completely lost. And by bringing that back, maybe we bring back some of that family values that we think about of the 50s, 60s into the 70s. Maybe we bring back some of that community where people are doing better.
Yeah, I think that's right. And this is actually not rocket science or any sort of like strange economic theory, because we have seen this play out in real time in a lot of communities around the industrial heartland. And you just think, think of the cities in Pennsylvania that are a shell of their former selves, like Reading or Erie. And I'm just getting started. I mean, you can name dozens and dozens of cities, Bethlehem. I mean, you can go on and on and on where factories were the anchor, they left. You know, the population went down, the town got a lot poorer, and it takes a generation to recover from that. And I think, and I know I've had great conversations with Ro Khanna about this, the congressman from California, and this is about reindustrializing the right way, high road, engaging labor in this, because we're never going to win a race to the bottom.
Correct.
But we can rebuild this if there's some intent to do that. Like, we know how to make semiconductors. We know how to make steel. We know how to make autos. It's just that the choices that, like, the Milton Friedman kind of school and shareholders made were like, no, even if you can squeeze a couple other pennies out to make it in another country, we want to do that. And everybody's now discovered the folly of that. It's not just factory workers or those laid off factory workers who were suffering. You know, consumers were suffering a lot during the pandemic, and they saw price spikes and you couldn't get stuff and all of that. And that's what happens if we don't make stuff here. But I totally agree. And here's what differentiates, I think, a Ro Khanna and largely a Democratic vision of this versus what Trump sometimes says, which is like he wants to go back, right? And it's never going to be, look, we're not going to have a massive factory with 20,000 people on it. Yeah. That's not what this is about. But it is about building up a new kind of manufacturing on a high road where these jobs can stay here and support families. And you're right. When the unions are strong, when the factories are strong, you get strong community foundation. You get good little leagues. You get good bowling leagues. You get active churches. You get everything that goes along with that. And it really is kind of the bedrock of communities. And I totally agree with you, Rick. We ought to do whatever we can to try to make a new manufacturing powerhouse in all of these deindustrialized factory towns.
Yeah, I mean, there needs to be a revitalization. And look, Ro Khanna's been at the front of this, as has Joe Biden. The reality is we've done a number of investments in reshoring manufacturing. Much more needs to be done. We need sane, rational trade policies. We do need tariffs. And you know, I've had numerous arguments with people on the left who have, just because Trump has said we're going to tariff everything, they've come out against tariffs entirely. No, I'm not there. I think we need strategic use of the tool known as tariffs. I don't know that we can have an economy based on them. We can't go back 100 years and do that. But I think you do need the arrow in the quiver.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it would have been the easiest thing in the world for the Biden-Harris administration to toss the tariffs when they came in 4 years ago and say we're done with this, but they didn't. And you know, they built on it and you know, got a lot of public investment into infrastructure and into semiconductors and into clean energy manufacturing, and that found its way. It's making a difference. Those mills are modernizing. They're getting cleaner. Many of them have been hiring workers, and there's a good market outlook for a lot of this. And so it's a pretty good time to kind of like be in that manufacturing space. And we haven't been able to say that for decades. And so, and it's not accidental. It's because of this policy. You're right, Rick.
It's a matter of policy. And look, I look at the speech that Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, gave at the Brookings Institute, talking about, you know, how, you know, not only are we going to preserve our strength today, but we're going to extend that for generations by having the manufacturing capacity that we've given away over the last couple of decades.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's important, coming from the National Security Advisor, who traditionally has almost always been some free trade acolyte, right? Almost always. This has been the case in every single administration. But Jake Sullivan, I think, understands that economic security makes us stronger from a national security perspective, and that we need to do this to counter the influence of countries like Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea, and that we can only do that if we are an economic powerhouse and that we're making things in the United States. And then to build on it is that we can we can, sorry about that. To build on it, we can get our allies engaged in the same types of policies to contain China's overcapacity, their right. unfair trade practices, and it will put us in a better place and provide some of those opportunities that, as you mentioned, as Congressman Ro Khanna mentioned, that we're trying to get back in the United States.
Well, as Jake Sullivan pointed out, you know, we're using these tariffs and increasing some Section 301 tariffs on Chinese imports to essentially prevent a second China shock, his words. And that's something I think that we as consumers, we as workers, we as a nation, I would argue as a globe, should want to prevent.
Yeah. Yeah, the first China shock almost wiped out manufacturing in the United States. It came really close, really close. And we do not want to see that again. And here's what's happening. And I know it's probably hard for some of your listeners to accept this, but the United States has the best performing economy in the world right now. We do. We have relatively low unemployment and inflation that's coming down. We have strong fundamentals and we are ahead of everybody else. China is scraping now to kind of keep up. And the way that they do this is they just make stuff and make stuff and make stuff, even if nobody at home in China is buying it.
Yeah.
And what does that do? That spreads economic misery all over the world because factories start closing down here and there, anywhere that, that these Chinese imports can get in. And so, yeah, that's what Jake Sullivan was sounding the alarm bell. It's like, we've seen this before. We know it does not turn out well for the United States of America, and we are not going to let it happen again. And yeah, I love hearing that message because it is proactive. And it indicates a deep understanding of the threat, the economic threat that we can see by inaction and by following some free trade neoliberal philosophy.
Yeah, hopefully that is dead. And hopefully, again, I've been saying the Biden administration has been transformational in moving us away from the horrible of the 90s, the neoliberalism, the free trade, the slashing tax rates on the ultra wealthy and corporations, and moving back to old school. Good governance policy, sound investment, smart policy, and look, making things here in the U.S. Finally, I got to get your thought. We are in Halloween season. Made in America. You guys tweeted out Tootsie Rolls made in America, 128 years. That's kind of a big deal.
That is a big deal. And this is the great thing. A lot of the stuff in your Halloween bag is made in the United States. And we curated a list, and I know the AFL-CIO has a list of union-made, American-made candy as well. And it's awesome to celebrate things like that. I mean, I've been by the Tootsie Roll factory in Chicago several times. It's not far from Midway Airport. And it's really cool to think that for so long they've been making these things and that kids today are going to be able to enjoy them. So I love it. There's lots of way to keep your Halloween made in America. With candy that is sure to delight every single visitor to your door. So take advantage of it, please.
Yeah, see, in our household, it's one for you, one for me. That's how that goes.
That.
But Scott, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff. Thanks so much.
All right, Rick, thank you for happy Halloween, and thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
You as well. Our good friend Scott Paul, I want to hear your thoughts. How's the candy dish work in your house? I want to hear. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. And is it made in America? Do we buy the American-made, union-made candies? I want to hear it. rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1941. That was the day that the completed Mount Rushmore Monument was dedicated in the Black Hills of South Dakota. The monument portrays massive sculptures of U.S. Presidents George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, and Theodore Roosevelt hewn into the side of a mountain. Today, 3 million visitors view the sculpture each year. The project remains controversial because it was completed on land held sacred by the Lakota Sioux. 400 men worked for 14 years to complete the carvings. First, the men dynamited 450,000 tons of rock off the mountain. They then used jackhammers and hand chisels to complete the features of each of the president's faces. The sculptures were massive in scale. The president's faces are each as tall as a six-story building. George Washington's nose is 21 feet long. Many of the men working on the project were miners who had first come to the Black Hills in search of gold. The men were paid $8 an hour, considered an extremely good wage for the time. But they often had to endure layoffs as the funding for the project waned. Despite the dangerous conditions of completing such a project, not one worker died during its construction. Gulzon Borglum, a Danish-American sculptor, headed the effort. He died several months before its final completion, and his son had to oversee the end of the work. The head carver at Rushmore was an Italian immigrant by the name of Luigi Del Bianco. Del Bianco later died of ulcerated silicosis. His lungs were filled with silica dust from working on the carving. In a 1966 newspaper interview, Del Bianco declared, "I'd do it again," even knowing all of the hardships involved. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So I got to tell you, every Halloween we look for union-made candy, American-made products, and I look for the union label on the back of the containers. Sadly, a lot of companies have moved their production to Mexico and to other places. Hershey, for instance, moved a good portion of their production to Mexico. So you literally have to check where things are made. You can't assume that our food is made here, because sadly, that's not the reality in the world we live in. Oreos, for instance, I stopped buying Oreos for the most part because it's getting harder and harder to find the ones that are made here in the U.S. We always look, and when I see made in Mexico, they go right back on the shelf. That's just me. And look, until we as consumers start demanding that our products are made here, are made with good working conditions and decent wages, and to create that economy that we all want, with good paying jobs for everybody, it's never going to change otherwise. And, you know, the weird thing is I go back to Ro Khanna's tweet where, you know, my grandparents' generation, you know, one in four workers worked in a manufacturing facility. Millions more worked in trucking and construction. There were plenty of jobs for men to do, for people to do. And I think of my grandfather who actually, he quit three jobs in one day, because back in that era, jobs were plentiful and good jobs. Not like today where you get on and say, oh, I got to hold on to this because, you know, the next ones are going to be worse. In that era, employers were competing for workers. So the wages had to be better. The conditions had to be better. You know, this moment that we're in, employers know that they've got the pick. And they can pit people against each other, because they know we've lost a good number of those manufacturing jobs. And, you know, as I was talking to Scott there a moment ago, I couldn't help but think, as he was talking about the communities across Pennsylvania that have lost manufacturing and those communities that lost those jobs and the revenue that kept those towns afloat, I couldn't help but think of our Working Class Heroes tour from 2022. Where we went to a lot of the places that used to be productive, have productive factories that ship products all around the world, that was the pride of that community. I was reminded there of a rally that happened in Harrisburg it was definitely Governor Corbett's administration, the Republican Governor Corbett, who. One-term Tom, as he was known, because he was such a bad governor, slashed, you know, investments in education, slashed investments in higher ed, just went after every bit of the right-wing wet dream list. And I remember there were a bunch of college students who made their way to the Capitol for a rally. And I was invited to go and speak to the crowd. And as I was waiting, waiting my turn, I was talking to some of the people who were standing behind the stage, or on the stage behind the speakers, and one kid caught my attention. And we just kind of struck up a conversation. And I said, how is this cut going to affect you? You know, what is it that why are you here? And he said, look, this is going to increase tuition, because they were talking about cutting like an enormous, like 70%. I mean, it was some outrageous, crazy number to higher education, which would have raised tuitions just completely through the roof. And he said, look, I can't afford any more, but this is my only hope. This is my only shot at leading the American dream. This is my only path to leading a middle-class lifestyle. He goes, I'll be the first in my family to go to college and to graduate. I'm going to be the first in my family to get a job with a degree. And he said, look, you know, my grandfather wanted to go to college. But, you know, the Korean War popped up and, you know, he didn't get to go because he went to serve the country. He came home. He worked in the factory. His father went off to Vietnam, didn't get to go to college because he went off to Vietnam. He came back, had some problems. He went to work in the factory. The default was you just go work in the factory. The factory is going to get you a good, solid wage. It's going to give you a good living. You're going to get that house. You're going to get that white picket fence. You're going to have your 2.3 kids. You're going to have cars in the driveway. You're going to take vacations. You're going to be able to do lots of things that this job, this productive earning job is going to afford your family. It's going to give you a lifestyle that is, it's good. You're going to be okay. You may have wanted to pursue something better. You may have wanted to do something, but the factory job was stable. You were going to be able to support your family. And it was dignified work. It was valued work. It was respected work. And he looked at me dead in the eye and he goes, I don't have the factory to fall back on. This is my only shot. This is all I have. And they're taking it from me. And now look, this is, you know, 2010, I believe it was. And all these years, that has stuck with me, because that idea that there's nothing, there's no default, there's no falling back. That if we try and we strike out, there's only free fall. That is not a way to have an economy. That is not a way to encourage people to want to strive to do something more, to strike out on their own. And if they fail, that they're going to be okay because there's a default. And the factory jobs were that default. Look, they weren't, you didn't need to be college educated to do it. You need to have some skills, some real skills, some good common sense, some good smarts, some ability to actually turn things into something with your hands. There was dignity, there was pride, there was respect in those jobs, as there should have been and should be today. But we gave those away. We sacrificed a generation of workers who had the fallback, the default. If what I want to do doesn't work out, I can go back to the factory. That default for far too many people and far too many communities across this country was wiped out. And not because of, you know, good old-fashioned competition. No, it was wiped out because corporate America wanted more. Corporate America sold us that we were going to get really cheap stuff. It was going to be this amazing living. We were all going to be fine. It was going to be good. We were all going to get corner office jobs. It was going to be nirvana. It was going to be utopia. It was going to be great. And what it turned out to be is crummy service sector jobs that don't pay anywhere near enough to raise a family on, to now you have to have two, three, four of them just to make ends meet. So for me, smart policy, sound investment to reshore manufacturing, no freaking brainer. And good on Joe Biden for doing it. Want to hear your thoughts. Is this your story? Have you heard that kind of a story in your lifetime? I want to hear about it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you will find ours. freespeech.org to get the video. And as always, thanks for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at Rick@TheRickSmithShow.
This is Civic Media, bringing you news, talk, and community-minded conversations all across Wisconsin.